specific forms of control that, they assumed, will be actively feared and resented by many. Despite the wide range of scenarios that Kahn presented in his book on the distant year 2000, Kahn's voyage into the unthinkable was viewed by the public as a way to prepare for the worst possible outcome in a terrifying nightmare of social controls. Yet now, that same nightmare is rendered as an enthusiastic progress report on surveillance capitalism's latest triumphs. Varian's update is delivered without self-consciousness or a hint of controversy, rather than the astonishment and revulsion that were predicted just decades ago. How has the nightmare become banal? Where is our sense of astonishment and outrage? Political scientist Langdon Winner grappled with this question in his seminal book Autonomous Technology, published in 1977. His answer? "What we lack is our bearings," he wrote. Winner painstakingly described the ways in which our experience of things technological confounds our vision, our expectations, and our capacity to make intelligent judgments. Categories, arguments, conclusions, and choices that would have been entirely obvious in earlier times are obvious no longer. So let us establish our bearings. What Varian celebrates here is not a new form of contract, but rather a final solution to the enduring uncertainty that is the raison d'etre of contract as a means of private ordering. In fact, the use of the word contract in Varian's formulation is a perfect example of the horseless carriage syndrome. Varian's invention is unprecedented and cannot be understood as simply another kind of contract. It is, in fact, the annihilation of contract. This invention is better understood as the uncontract. The uncontract is a feature of the larger complex that is the means of behavioral modification, and it is therefore an essential modality of surveillance capitalism. It contributes to economies of action by leveraging proprietary behavioral surplus to preempt and foreclose action alternatives, thus replacing the interdeterminacy of social processes with the determinism of programmed machine processes. This is not the automation of society, as some might think, but rather the replacement of society with machine action dictated by economic imperatives. The uncontract is not a space of contractual relations, but rather a unilateral execution that makes those relations unnecessary. The uncontract desocializes the contract, manufacturing certainty through the substitution of automated procedures for promises, dialogue, shared meaning, problem-solving, dispute resolution, and trust. The expressions of solidarity and human agency that have been gradually institutionalized in the notion of contract over the course of millennia. The uncontract bypasses all that social work in favor of compulsion, and it does so for the sake of more lucrative prediction products that approximate observation and therefore guarantee outcomes. This substitution of machine work for social work is possible thanks to the success of Google's declarations and the road that Google paved for surveillance capitalists' dominance of the division of learning. Sitting in the catbird seat, Google can observe what was previously unobservable and know what was previously unknowable. As a result, the company can do what was previously undoable, bypass social relations in favor of automated machine processes that compel the behaviors that advance commercial objectives. When we celebrate the uncontract, as Varian and others do, we celebrate the asymmetries of knowledge and power that produce these new possibilities. The uncontract is a signpost that reminds us of our bearings as we follow the next sections of this chapter toward a clearer picture of surveillance capitalism's growing ambitions in the annexation of reality to its kingdom of conquered human experience. 7. Inevitabilism. It is difficult to keep your bearings when everyone around you is losing theirs. The transition to ubiquitous computing, when sensors are everywhere, Paradiso writes, won't be incremental, but rather a revolutionary phase shift, much like the arrival of the World Wide Web. The same phase shift that is understood by its architects as the universal antidote to uncertainty is anticipated with absolute certainty. Paradiso is not alone here. On the contrary, the rhetoric of inevitability is so ubiquitous that within the tech company it can be considered a full-blown ideology of inevitabilism. The sense of incontestable certainty that infuses Paradiso's vision has long been recognized as a key feature of utopianism. In their definitive history of utopian thought, Frank and Fritz Emanuel wrote that, since the end of the 18th century, the predictive utopia has become a major form of imaginative thought and has preempted certain scientific techniques of forecasting the contemporary utopia. Binds past, present, and future together as though fated. The state they depict appears virtually ordained either by God or by history. There is a carryover of millenarian certainty. The Manuels, along with many other historians, consider Marxism to be the last great modern utopia. There are hundreds of passages in Karl Marx's writing that convey his inevitabilism. In the very first section of the Communist Manifesto, published in 1848, Marx wrote the following: "What the bourgeoisie, therefore, produces above all is its own gravediggers. Its fall and the victory of the proletariat are equally inevitable." Before the rise of the modern utopia, the genre was largely composed of fantastical narratives in which isolated pockets of human perfection were discovered in exotic mountain areas, hidden valleys, or faraway islands. Modern utopias, such as Marxism, diverge from those fairy tales, addressing the reformation of the entire species with a rational, systemic vision whose province was the whole world. No longer content as mere weavers of dreams, modern utopianists shifted toward totalistic and universal visions, prophecies of the ineluctable end toward which mankind was moving. Now, the proselytizers of ubiquitous computing join Marx and other modern utopianists in postulating a new phase of history. Like Paradiso's revolutionary phase shift, in which all of society is reassembled in a novel and superior pattern. Despite the fact that inevitability is the opposite of politics and history, apostles of the apparatus routinely hijack historical metaphors that lend a veneer of gravitas to their claims. The rise of the apparatus is alternatively cast as the inauguration of a new age, era, wave, phase, or stage. This kind of historical framing conveys the futility of opposition to the categorical inevitability of the march toward ubiquity. Silicon Valley is the axis mundi of inevitabilism. Among high-tech leaders, within the specialist literature, and among expert professionals, there appears to be universal agreement on the idea that everything will be connected, knowable, and actionable in the near future. Ubiquity and its consequences in total information are an article of faith. Not surprisingly, Google's leaders are passionate inevitabilists. The very first sentences of Schmidt and Cohen's 2013 book, The New Digital Age, exemplify this thrust. "Soon everyone on Earth will be connected," they write. So-called predictive laws, much as Moore's Law and photonics, are called upon to signal this new iron law of necessity that will produce exponential growth in connectivity and computational power. And later, the collective benefit of sharing human knowledge and creativity grows at an exponential rate. In the future, information technology will be everywhere, like electricity. It will be a given. When the book's assertions garnered some criticism, the authors confronted their critics in an afterword to the paperback edition. But bemoaning the inevitable increase in the size and reach of the technology sector distracts us from the real question. Many of the changes we discuss are inevitable. They're coming. Despite its pervasiveness, both in Silicon Valley and in the wider culture of data scientists and technology developers, inevitabilism is rarely discussed or critically evaluated. Paradiso's conception of a digital omniscience is taken for granted, with little discussion of politics, power, markets, or governments. As in most accounts of the apparatus, questions of individual autonomy, moral reasoning, social norms and values, privacy, decision rights, politics, and law take the form of afterthoughts and genuflections that can be solved with the correct protocols or addressed with still more technology solutions. If information will stream directly into our eyes and ears, and the boundaries of the individual will be very blurry, then who can access that information? What if I don't want my life streaming through your senses? Who knows? Who decides? Who decides who decides? The answers to such questions are drowned in the thrum of all things continuously illuminated, registered, counted, controlled, and judged. The best that Paradiso can offer up is a suggestion that the law could give a person ownership or control of data generated in his or her vicinity. A person could then choose to encrypt or restrict those data from entering the network. Paradiso imagines a society in which it falls to each individual to protect herself from the omniscient, ubiquitous, sensate computational systems of the new apparatus. Rather than paradise, it seems a recipe for a new breed of madness. Yet this is precisely the world that is now under construction around us, and this madness appears to be a happy feature of the plan. Between 2012 and 2015, I interviewed 52 data scientists and specialists in the Internet of Things. They came from 19 different companies with a combined 586 years of experience in high-technology corporations and startups, primarily in Silicon Valley. I spoke with them about the prominence of inevitability rhetoric among the purveyors of the new apparatus, and I posed the same question to each one. Why do so many people say that ubiquitous computing is inevitable? The agreement among their responses was striking. Although they did not have the language of surveillance capitalism, nearly every interviewee regarded inevitability rhetoric as a Trojan horse for powerful economic imperatives, and each one of them lamented the lack of any critical discussion of these assumptions. As the marketing director of a Silicon Valley firm that sells software to link smart devices told me, "There's all that dumb real estate out there, and we've got to turn it into revenue. The Internet of Things is all push, not pull. Most consumers do not feel a need for these devices. You can say exponential and inevitable as much as you want. The bottom line is that the Valley has decided that this has to be the next thing so that firms here can grow." I spoke with a senior engineer from a large tech company that invests heavily in the Internet of Things. The response: imagine you have a hammer. That's machine learning. It helped you climb a grueling mountain to reach the summit. That's machine learning's dominance of online data. On the mountaintop, you find a vast pile of nails, cheaper than anything previously imaginable. That's the new smart sensor tech. An unbroken vista of virgin board stretches before you as far as you can see. That's the whole dumb world. Then you learn that any time you plant a nail in a board with your machine learning hammer, you can extract value from that formerly dumb plank. That's data monetization. What do? You start hammering like crazy and you never stop, unless somebody makes you stop. But there is nobody up here to make us stop. This is why the Internet of Everything is inevitable. A senior systems architect laid out the imperative in the clearest terms. The IoT is inevitable, like getting to the Pacific Ocean was inevitable. It's manifest destiny. 98% of things in the world are not connected. So we're gonna connect them. It could be a moisture temperature that sits in the ground. It could be your liver. That's your IoT. The next step is what we do with the data. We'll visualize it, make sense of it, and monetize it. That's our IoT. 8. Men made it. The relentless drumbeat of inevitabilist messages presents the new apparatus of ubiquity as the product of technological forces that operate beyond human agency and the choices of communities, an implacable movement that originates outside history and exerts a momentum that, in some vague way, drives toward the perfection of the species and the planet. The image of technology as an autonomous force with unavoidable actions and consequences has been employed across the centuries to erase the fingerprints of power and absolve it of responsibility. The monster did it, not Victor Frankenstein. However, the ankle bracelet does not monitor the prisoner. The criminal justice system does that. Every doctrine of inevitability carries a weaponized virus of moral nihilism programmed to target human agency and delete resistance and creativity from the text of human possibility. Inevitability rhetoric is a cunning fraud designed to render us helpless and passive in the face of implacable forces that are and must always be indifferent to the merely human. This is the world of the robotized interface, where technologies work their will, resolutely protecting power from challenge. No one has expressed this with more insight and economy than John Steinbeck in the opening chapters of his masterwork, The Grapes of Wrath, which describes the Dust Bowl farmers who are thrown out of their Oklahoma homes during the Great Depression and then head west to California. The families are forced off the land that they have tended for generations. They plaintively argue their case to the bank agents sent to impress upon them the facts of their helplessness. But the agents respond with, "The bank is something else than men." It happens that every man in a bank hates what the bank does, and yet the bank does it. "The bank is something more than men, I tell you. It's the monster. Men made it, but they can't control it." This theme of supposed technological autonomy is a venerable one among technology scholars. Langdon Winner again proves to be a worthy guide when he reminds us that an unquestioning acceptance of technology has become a feature of modern life. The changes and disruptions that an evolving technology repeatedly caused in modern life were accepted as given or inevitable simply because no one bothered to ask whether there were other possibilities. Winner observes that we have allowed ourselves to become committed to a pattern of technological drift, defined as accumulated unanticipated consequences. We accept the idea that technology must not be impeded if society is to prosper, and in this way we surrender to technological determinism. Rational consideration of social values is considered retrograde, Winner writes, not the ticket that scientific technology gives to civilization. To this day, any suggestions that the forward flow of technological innovation be in any way limited violate a fundamental taboo. Instead, we accept the change, later looking back upon what we have done to ourselves as a topic of curiosity. To Winner's curiosity, I add another theme, remorse. Surveillance capitalist leaders assume that we will succumb to the naturalistic fallacy, as Steinbeck's farmers were meant to do. Because Google is successful, because surveillance capitalism is successful, its rules must obviously be right and good. Like the bank agents, Google wants us to accept that its rules simply reflect the requirements of autonomous processes, something that people cannot control. However, our grasp of the inner logic of surveillance capitalism suggests otherwise. Men and women made it, and they can control it. They merely choose not to do so. Inevitabilism enshrines the apparatus of ubiquity as progress, but conceals the realpolitik of surveillance capitalism at work behind the scenes. We know that there can be alternative paths to a robust information capitalism that produces genuine solutions for a third modernity. We have seen that surveillance capitalism was discovered and honed in history, handcrafted by men and women to serve the interests of impatient capital. It is this same logic that now demands ubiquity, ready to colonize technical developments for the sake of its imperatives and growth. Inevitabilism operates in the service of these imperatives as it distracts attention from the ambitions of a rising economic order and the competitive anxieties that drive the surveillance project toward certainty, thus necessitating its ever more voracious claims on our behavior. Inevitabilism precludes choice and voluntary participation. It leaves no room for human will as the author of the future. This raises questions. At what point does inevitabilism's claim to ubiquitous extraction and execution shade into abuse? Will inevitabilism's utopian declarations summon new forms of coercion designed to quiet restless populations unable to quell their hankering for a future of their choice? 9. To the Ground Campaign. Google's declarations, surveillance capitalism's dominance over the division of learning in society and its laws of motion, ubiquitous architectures of extraction and execution, McKay's penetration of inaccessible regions while observing unrestrained animals with methods that elude their awareness, the uncontract and its displacement of society, Paradiso's ubiquitous sensate environment, dark data, the inevitabilism evangelists. There is one place where all these elements come together and transform a shared public space built for human engagement into a petri dish for the reality business of surveillance capitalism. That place is the city. Cisco has 120 smart cities globally, some of which have embraced Cisco Kinetic, which, as Jahangir Mohammed, the company's vice president and general manager of IoT, explains in a blog post, is a cloud-based platform that helps customers extract, compute, and move data from connected things to IoT applications to deliver better outcomes. Cisco Kinetic gets the right data to the right applications at the right time, while executing policies to enforce data ownership, privacy, security, and even data sovereignty laws. But, as is so often the case, the most audacious effort to transform the urban commons into the surveillance capitalist's equivalent of Paradiso's 250-acre marsh comes from Google, which has introduced and legitimated the concept of the for-profit city. Just as McKay had counseled and Weiser proselytized, the computer would be operational everywhere and detectable nowhere, always beyond the edge of individual awareness. In 2015, shortly after Google reorganized itself into a holding company called Alphabet, Sidewalk Labs became one of 9 confirmed companies under the Alphabet corporate umbrella. Whether what even Sidewalk CEO Dan Doktoroff, a former private equity financier, CEO of Bloomberg and deputy mayor of New York City in the Bloomberg administration, refers to as a Google city succeeds, the company has interested the public by recasting our central gathering place as a commercial operation in which once public assets and functions are reborn as the cornered raw materials earmarked for a new marketplace. In this vision, McKay and Paradiso's conceptions come to fruition under the auspices of surveillance capitalism in a grand scheme of vertically integrated supply, production, and sales. Sidewalk Labs' first public undertaking was the installation of several hundred free, internet-enabled kiosks in New York City, ostensibly to combat the problem of digital inequality. As we saw with Google Street View, the company can siphon a lot of valuable information about people from a Wi-Fi network, even if they don't use the kiosks. Doktoroff has characterized the Sidewalk Labs kiosks as fountains of data that will be equipped with environmental sensors and also collect other data, all of which can create very hyper-local information about conditions in the city. In 2016, the U.S. Department of Transportation, DOT, announced a partnership with Sidewalk Labs to funnel transit data to city officials. The DOT worked to draw cities into Google's orbit with a competition for $40 million in grants. Winners would work with Sidewalk Labs to integrate technology into municipal operations. But Sidewalk Labs was eager to work with finalists in order to develop its own traffic management system, Flow. Flow relies on Google Maps, Street View vehicles, and machine intelligence to capture and analyze data from drivers and public spaces. These analyses produce prediction products described as inferences about where people are coming from or going, enabling administrators to run virtual experiments and improve traffic flow. Doktorov postulates a city presided over by digital omniscience. We're taking everything from anonymized smartphone data from billions of miles, trips, sensor data, and bringing that into a platform. Sidewalk refers to its high-tech services as new superpowers to extend access and mobility. Algorithms designed to maintain critical behaviors within a prescribed zone of action would manage these data flows. In a world in which we can monitor things like noise or vibrations, why do we need to have these very prescriptive building codes? As an alternative, Doktorov suggests performance-based zoning administered by the ubiquitous apparatus through the medium of algorithms. These processes, like Varian's vehicular monitoring systems, are indifferent to why you behave, as long as they can monitor and control the behavior you produce. As Doktorov explains it, I don't care what you put here, as long as you don't exceed performance standards like noise levels. This is preferable, he says, because it enhances the free flow of property that is a logical extension of these technologies. Why should citizens have any say over their communities and the long-term implications of how luxury high-rises, hotels, or a residential building going commercial could affect rents and local businesses as long as an algorithm is satisfied with noise thresholds? When Columbus, Ohio was named winner of the DOT competition, it began a 3-year demonstration project with Sidewalk, including 100 kiosks and free access to the Flow software. Documents and correspondence from this collaboration, eventually obtained by The Guardian, described innovations such as dynamic parking, optimized parking enforcement, and a shared mobility marketplace that reveal a more troubling pattern than the rhetoric suggests. Sidewalk's data flows combine public and private assets for sale in dynamic, real-time virtual markets that extract maximum fees from citizens and leave municipal governments dependent upon Sidewalk's proprietary information. For example, public and private parking spaces are combined in online markets and rented on demand as the cost of parking varies in real time, substantially increasing parking income. Optimized parking enforcement depends on Sidewalk's algorithms to calculate the most lucrative routes for parking cops, earning cities millions of extra dollars that they desperately need, but that arrive at the expense of their citizens. Cities are required to invest substantial public monies in Sidewalk's technology platform, including channeling municipal funds earmarked for low-cost public bus service into mobility markets that rely on private ride-sharing companies such as Uber. The company insists that cities share public transport data with ride-sharing companies, allowing Uber to direct cars to overcrowded bus stops. The Flow transit system integrates information and payment for nearly every kind of transport into Google Maps, and cities are obligated to upgrade to Sidewalk's mobile payment system for all existing transit and parking services. Just as it requires public transit data, Sidewalk also insists that cities share all parking and ridership information with Sidewalk Labs in real time. When asked, Doktorov has emphasized the novel blending of public functions and private gain, assuring his listeners on both counts that our mission is to use technology to change cities, to bring technology to solve big urban problems. We expect to make a lot of money from this. In April 2016, a curated group of leaders in tech, media, and finance met at the Yale Club in Manhattan to hear Sidewalk CEO Dan Doctoroff's talk, Google City, How the Tech Juggernaut is Reimagining Cities Faster Than You Realize. His remarks provide a candid assessment of the Google City as a market operation shaped by the prediction imperative. He could not have been more direct in articulating Sidewalk Labs' approach as a translation of Google's online world to the reality of city life. In effect, what we're doing is replicating the digital experience in physical space. So, ubiquitous connectivity, incredible computing power, including artificial intelligence and machine learning, the ability to display data, sensing, including cameras and location data, as well as other kinds of specialized sensors. We fund it all through a very novel advertising model. We can actually then target ads to people in proximity, and then, obviously, over time, track them through things like beacons and location services, as well as their browsing activity. Later that year, Sidewalk announced collaborations with 16 additional cities, noting that achieving scale would enable it to improve its Flow software products. Doctoroff referred to these collaborations as inevitable. The vast and varied ground campaign already underway turns the prediction imperative into concrete activity. In pursuit of economies of scope, a wave of novel machine processes are honed for extraction, rendering people and things as behavioral data. For the sake of economies of action, the apparatus learns to interrupt the flow of personal experience in order to influence, modify, and direct our behavior, guided by the plans and interests of self-authorizing commercial actors and the buzzing market cosmos in which they participate. In nearly every case, the agents of institutionalization present their novel practices as if they are one thing, when they are, in fact, something altogether different. The realpolitik of commercial surveillance operations is concealed offstage, while the chorus of actors singing and dancing under the spotlights holds our attention, and sometimes even our enthusiasm. They sweat under the stage lights for the sake of one aim, that we fail to notice the answers, or, better yet, forget to ask the questions, who knows, who decides, who decides who decides. In light of these ambitions, it is not surprising that Doctoroff, like Page, prefers lawless space. Press reports confirmed that Alphabet Google was actively considering a proposal for a new city, and that more than 100 urban planners, researchers, technologists, building experts, economists, and consultants were involved in the project. The Wall Street Journal reported that although it was unclear how the company would fund the tens of billions of dollars necessary for such a large-scale undertaking, one key element is that Sidewalk would be seeking autonomy from many city regulations so it could build without constraints. In October 2017, Doctoroff appeared with Alphabet Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to reveal that Toronto would be the site of Sidewalk's planned development. Its intent is to develop the right mix of technology that it can then license to cities around the world. The genesis of the thinking for Sidewalk Labs came from Google's founders getting excited, thinking of all the things you could do if someone would just give us a city and put us in charge. Toronto's Globe and Mail reported Schmidt as saying, noting that he joked he knew there were good reasons that doesn't happen. Then, just as quickly, the paper related Schmidt's reaction when he first learned that Sidewalk, and by extension Alphabet, had secured this opportunity in Toronto. Oh my God, we've been selected. Now it's our turn. Chapter 8. Rendition. From Experience to Data. You take a picture of them, they'll kill you. They think you're taking something away from them. That you only got so much stuff. And if other people are taking it all, then there ain't none left for yourself. Robert Garland, The Electric Horseman. To photograph is to appropriate the thing photographed. It means putting oneself into a certain relation to the world that feels like knowledge, and therefore, like power. Susan Sontag, on photography. 1. Terms of surrender. We worry about companies that amass our personal data, and we wonder why they should profit. Who owns the data, we ask. But every discussion of data protection or data ownership omits the most important question of all. Why is our experience rendered as behavioral data in the first place? It has been far too easy to overlook this important step in the chain of events that produces behavioral surplus. This chapter and the next draw our attention to the gap between experience and data, as well as to the specific operations that target this gap, on a mission to transform the one into the other. I call these operations rendition. We have seen that the dispossession of human experience is the original sin of surveillance capitalism, but this dispossession is not mere abstraction. Rendition describes the concrete operational practices through which dispossession is accomplished, as human experience is claimed as raw material for datafication and all that follows, from manufacturing to sales. A focus on these intermediate practices illustrates that the apparatus of ubiquity is not a passive one-way mirror. Rather, it actively creates its own stores of knowledge through rendition. The noun rendition derives from the verb render, a most unusual word whose double meanings describe a two-sided equation that perfectly captures what happens in the gap between human experience and behavioral data. On one side of the equation, the verb describes a process in which something is formed out of something else that is originally given. It designates the casual action of turning one thing into another, such as rendering oil from fat, extraction, or rendering an English text from the original Latin, translation. These meanings have also found their way into the vocabulary of digital technology. For example, a rendering engine converts the coded content of an HTML page for display and printing. On the other side of the equation, render also describes the way in which the thing that is changed gives itself over to this process. It surrenders. The verb rendre first appears in 10th century French, meaning to give back, present, yield, as in rendering an account, or the tree renders its fruit. By the 14th century, the word also incorporated the idea of handing over, delivering, or acknowledging dependency or obligation, as in render unto Caesar. These meanings are active today when we say rendering a verdict, rendering service, or rendering property. Surveillance capitalism must work both sides of the equation. On one side, its technologies are designed to render our experience into data, as in rendering oil from fat. This typically occurs outside of our awareness, let alone our consent. On the other side of the equation, every time we encounter a digital interface, we make our experience available to datafication, thus rendering unto surveillance capitalism its continuous tithe of raw material supplies. The two-sided equation is a novel arrangement. As we saw in Chapter 1, the Aware Home Project developed at Georgia Tech just a year before the invention of surveillance capitalism employed different practices that embodied very different assumptions. One, that it must be the individual alone who decides what experience is rendered as data. Two, that the purpose of the data is to enrich the individual's life. And three, that the individual is the sole arbiter of how the data are shared or put to use. Nearly two decades later, the Aware Home is barely more than an archaeological fragment reminding us of the road not taken toward an empowering digital future and a more just division of learning in society. Down that road, it is the individual who knows, decides, and decides who decides. An end in herself, not a means to others' ends. The lesson of the aware home is that there can be rendition without surveillance capitalism. However, the lesson of this chapter and the next is that there can be no surveillance capitalism without rendition. Nothing is exempt, as products and services from every sector join devices like the Nest thermostat in the competition for surveillance revenues. For example, in July 2017, iRobot's autonomous vacuum cleaner, Roomba, made headlines when the company's CEO, Colin Engel, told Reuters about its data-based business strategy for the smart home, starting with a new revenue stream derived from selling floor plans of customers' homes scraped from the machine's new mapping capabilities. Engel indicated that iRobot could reach a deal to sell its maps to Google, Amazon, or Apple within the next 2 years. In preparation for this entry into surveillance competition, a camera, new sensors, and software had already been added to Roomba's premier line, enabling new functions, including the ability to build a map while tracking its own location. The market had rewarded iRobot's growth vision, sending the company's stock price to $102 in June 2017 from just $35 a year earlier, translating into a market capitalization of $2.5 billion on revenues of $660 million. Privacy experts raised alarms, knowing that such data streams have virtually no legal or security protection. But Engel assured the public that iRobot would not sell data without its customers' permission and expressed confidence that most would give their consent in order to access the smart home functions. Why was Engel so confident? According to the company's privacy policy, it is true that owners of the Roomba can control or stop the collection of usage data by disconnecting your Wi-Fi or Bluetooth from the app. For example, by changing your Wi-Fi password. However, as Engel told tech site Mashable in July 2017, even when customers do not opt into the mapping service, the Roomba captures mapping and usage data, but only usage data is sent to the cloud so it can be shown on your mobile device. What Engel neglected to say was that a customer who refuses to share his or her home's interior mapping data with iRobot also loses most of the smart functionality of the autonomous vacuum cleaner, including the ability to use one's phone to start or pause a cleaning, schedule cleanings, review clean map reports, receive automatic software updates, or start a spot clean to focus on a particularly dirty area. Engel's confidence-enhancing strategy goes to the heart of the larger rendition project, for which surveillance capitalist purveyors of smart home products have developed a singular approach. On the one hand, they stress that customers can opt into data sharing. On the other hand, customers who refuse to opt in face limited product functionality and data security. In these requerimiento-style relationships, instead of the adelantados message, "Bend the knee or we destroy you," the message here is, "Bend the knee or we degrade your purchase." Under this new regime, something as simple as buying a mattress now requires careful legal scrutiny of the abusive contracts that nearly everyone ignores. Consider the Sleep Number bed with its smart bed technology and sleep tracking. The company's website features a beautiful couple snuggled in bed, happily glued to their smartphones, as they delight in data from their Sleep IQ app. The bed's base and mattress are customizable, with features that raise or lower the angle of the bed and sensors that soften or firm up the mattress. Other sensors measure heart rate, breathing, and movement. Every morning, you'll get your Sleep IQ score, representing your individual quality and length of sleep, your restful sleep, restless sleep, and time out of bed, and what adjustments you can make. The company suggests that you connect your sleep app to your fitness tracker and your thermostat in order to see how your workout or bedroom temperature affects your sleep. A dense 12-page privacy policy accompanies the bed. Customers are advised that providing information is an affirmation of consent to use that information in line with the policy, which employs the usual onerous terms, third-party sharing, Google Analytics, targeted advertising, and much more. In addition, if customers create a user profile to maximize the effectiveness of the app, the company also collects biometric and sleep-related data about how you, a child, or any person that uses the bed slept, such as that person's movement, positions, respiration, and heart rate while sleeping. It also collects all the audio signals in your bedroom. As with most such policies, customers are advised that the company can share or exploit personal information even after you deactivate or cancel the services and/or your Sleep Number account or user profiles. Customers are warned that no data transmission or storage can be guaranteed to be 100% secure and that it does not honor do not track notifications. Finally, on page 8 of the document, the policy addresses a customer's choices regarding the use of personal information. Whether you submit information to us is entirely up to you. If you decide to not submit information, we may not be able to provide certain features, products, and/or services to you. This same coercive requerimiento twist can be found in the lengthy, dense legal compacts associated with the Alphabet-owned Nest thermostats. The terms of service and end-user licensing agreements reveal oppressive privacy and security consequences in which sensitive information is shared with other devices, unnamed personnel, and third parties for the purposes of analysis and ultimately for trading in behavioral futures markets, action that ricochets back to the owner in the form of targeted ads and messages designed to push more products and services. Despite this, courts have generally upheld companies' claims that they bear no liability without a clear demonstration of economic harm to the consumer. Nest takes little responsibility for the security of that information, and none for how other companies will put it to use. In fact, University of London legal scholars Guido Noto-Ladiega and Ian Walden, who analyzed these documents, reckon that were one to enter into the Nest ecosystem of connected devices and apps, each with their own equally burdensome terms, the purchase of a single home thermostat entails the need to review nearly 1,000 contracts. This absurdity is compounded by the fact that virtually no one reads even one such contract. A valuable empirical study of 543 participants familiar with surveillance and privacy law issues, found that when asked to join a new online service, 74% opted for the quick join procedure, bypassing the terms of service agreement and the privacy policy. Among those who did scroll through the abusive contracts, most went directly to the accept button. The researchers calculated that the documents required at least 45 minutes for adequate comprehension, but for those who looked at the agreements, the median time they spent was 14 seconds. Should the customer refuse to agree to Nest's stipulations, the terms of service indicate that the functionality and security of the thermostat itself will be deeply compromised, no longer supported by the necessary updates meant to ensure its reliability and safety. The consequences can range from frozen pipes to failed smoke alarms to an easily hacked internal home system. In short, the effectiveness and safety of the product are brazenly held hostage to its owner's submission to rendition as conquest by and for others' interests. One can easily choose not to purchase a Roomba, a Sleep Number bed, or a Nest thermostat. But each of these is merely emblematic of the immense project of rendition as the first and vital step in the construction of the apparatus of ubiquity. Thousands of Internet of Things objects are becoming available. As LaDiega and Walden conclude, in this new product regime, the simple product functions that we seek are now hopelessly enmeshed in a tangled mixture of software, services, and networks. The very idea of a functional, effective, affordable product or service as a sufficient basis for economic exchange is dying. Where you might least expect it, products of every sort are remade by the new economic requirements of connection and rendition. Each is reimagined as a gateway to the new apparatus, praised for being smart, while traditional alternatives are reviled for remaining dumb. It is important to acknowledge that in this context, smart is a euphemism for rendition. Intelligence that is designed to render some tiny corner of lived experience as behavioral data. Each smart object is a kind of marionette. For all its smartness, it remains a hapless puppet dancing to the puppet master's hidden economic imperatives. Products, services, and applications march to the drumbeat of inevitabilism, toward the promise of surveillance revenues hacked from the still wild spaces that we call my reality, my home, my life, and my body. Every smart product repeats our essential questions. What does a smart product know, and whom does it tell? Who knows? Who decides? Who decides who decides? Examples of products determined to render, monitor, record, and communicate behavioral data proliferate, from smart vodka bottles to internet-enabled rectal thermometers, and quite literally everything in between. The business developer for a spirits company thus cites his plan for a connected bottle. The more we learn about consumers and their behaviors, the better services we can connect to them. Many brands are determined to give packaging a speaking role in an increasingly interactive marketplace. Global spirits distributor Diageo promises smart sensor-equipped bottles that can track purchases and sales data and, most importantly, communicate with consumers' devices and switch gears, recipes versus sales promos, once the bottle is opened. A producer of bar equipment states the case plainly enough. It really is all about allowing these bar owners to see stuff that they couldn't see before and maximize their profits. Today, our homes are in surveillance capitalism's crosshairs as competitors chased a $14.7 billion market for smart home devices in 2017, up from $6.8 billion just a year earlier, and expected to reach more than $101 billion by 2021. You may have already encountered some of the early absurdities. Smart toothbrushes, smart light bulbs, smart coffee mugs, smart ovens, smart juicers, and smart utensils said to improve your digestion. Others are often more grim. A home security camera with facial recognition. An alarm system that monitors unusual vibrations before a break-in occurs. Indoor GPS locators. Sensors that attach to any object to analyze movement, temperature, and other variables. Every kind of connected appliance. Cyborg cockroaches designed to detect sound. Even the baby's nursery is reconceived as a source of fresh behavioral surplus. An appreciation of the surveillance logic of accumulation that drives this action suggests that this network of things is already evolving into a network of coercion, in which mundane functions are ransomed for behavioral surplus. A December 2013 letter from Google's finance director to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission's Division of Corporate Finance provides a vivid glimpse of these facts. The letter was composed in response to an SEC query on the segmentation of Google's revenues between its desktop and mobile platforms. Google answered by stating that users would be viewing our ads on an increasingly wide diversity of devices in the future, and that its advertising systems were therefore moving toward device-agnostic design that made segmentation irrelevant and impractical. A few years from now, the letter stated, we and other companies could be serving ads and other content on refrigerators, car dashboards, thermostats, glasses and watches, to name just a few possibilities. Here is at least one endgame. The smart home and its Internet of Things are the canvas upon which the new markets in future behavior inscribe their presence and assert their demands in our most intimate spaces. Key to the story is that all of this action is prosecuted in support of a larger market process that bets on the future of our behavior, and over which we have no knowledge or control. Each node in the network, the vacuum cleaner, the mattress, the thermostat, must play its part, beginning with the frictionless rendition of behavior as the whole team of seething, insistent smart things joins the migration to surveillance revenues. As we are shorn of alternatives, we are forced to purchase products that we can never own, while our payments fund our own surveillance and coercion. Adding insult to injury, data rendered by this wave of things are notoriously insecure and easily subject to breaches. Moreover, manufacturers have no legal responsibility to notify device owners when data are stolen or hacked. There are other, even more grandiose ambitions for the rendition of all solitary things. Companies such as Qualcomm, Intel, and ARM are developing tiny, always-on, low-power computer vision modules that can be added to any device, such as your phone, or refrigerator, or any surface. A Qualcomm executive says that appliances and toys can now know what's going on around them. A doll could detect when a child's face turns toward it. Consider Smart Skin, developed by brilliant university scientists and now poised for commercial elaboration. Initially valued for its ability to monitor and diagnose health conditions, from Parkinson's disease to sleep disorders, Smart Skin is now hailed for its promise of ultra-unobtrusive ubiquity. Researchers at Georgia Tech developed a version of Smart Skin that sucks energy from radio waves and other energy sources, eliminating the need for batteries. Smart Skin, described as the ultimate sensing tool that could potentially allow for the mass implementation of perpetual wireless networks, can cognize, sense, analyze, wirelessly communicate, and modify parameters using simple radio frequency, RFID technology. As in the case of Paradiso's sensor tape, the researchers stress that it can also be applied everywhere to monitor, sense, and interact with the world around us in a perpetual way, thus significantly enhancing ambient intelligence, all of it as inconspicuous as a decal sticker. They suggest, for example, the shelves of grocery stores, where revenue opportunities are plentiful. Rendition has become a surveillance capitalist project shaped by its imperatives and directed toward its objectives. In the composition of the shadow text, rendition is step one. The concrete operationalization of the original sin of simple robbery that defined this market project from the start. Google rendered the earth, its streets, and its dwelling places, bypassing our consent and defying our protests. Facebook rendered the social network and its limitless details for the sake of the company's behavioral futures markets. Now the ubiquitous apparatus is the means to the ubiquitous rendition of human experience. We have seen the urgency with which surveillance capitalists pursue the elimination of friction as a critical success factor in supply operations. The prediction imperative makes boundaries and borders intolerable, and surveillance capitalists will do almost anything to eliminate them. This pursuit transforms connection into a commercial imperative and transforms individual autonomy into a threat to surveillance revenues. Surveillance capitalism's rendition practices overwhelm any sensible discussion of opt-in and opt-out. There are no more fig leaves. The euphemisms of consent can no longer divert attention from the bare facts. Under surveillance capitalism, rendition is typically unauthorized, unilateral, gluttonous, secret, and brazen. These characteristics summarize the asymmetries of power that put the surveillance in surveillance capitalism. They also highlight a harsh truth. It is difficult to be where rendition is not. As industries far beyond the technology sector are lured by surveillance profits, the ferocity of the race to find and render experience as data has turned rendition into a global project of surveillance capital. This chapter and the next survey a range of rendition activities in the pursuit of economies of scope. The remainder of this chapter concentrates on extension, the first dimension of scope, as rendition operations move into the real world, seizing fresh, unexpected chunks of human experience. Extension wants every corner and crevice, every utterance and gesture on the path to dispossession. All that is moist and alive must hand over its facts. There can be no shadow, no darkness. This unknown is intolerable. The solitary is forbidden. Later in Chapter 9, we move into the depth